Right.
Yeah.
That would be helpful, which Michaelis is going to talk about.
But first, thank you for asking us to be here. Like, it's really awesome and it's such an honor and a privilege to be able to participate in any meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I just want to welcome all the newcomers. This is so awesome. The energy around this is like fucking dope. So, yeah, we're really grateful.
Yeah, Michaelis is really like, this is a happy room.
Yeah, it's so cool. And Rachel, thank you for asking us to speak. So, yeah, I think sobriety is really important if you're going to have like emotional sobriety. And I think it's important to understand just what alcoholism is and like what the solution for alcoholism is and what is not alcoholism. Because I think it gets confusing. It was certainly confusing for me when I got sober. So what I learned through the Big Book, actually, because that's where the program of AA actually exists, is that alcoholism is really just about having an allergy to drugs and alcohol, you know? And what that means is that when I ingest drugs and alcohol in my body, I wind up triggering a craving that's beyond my mental control, right? And that's like, I can't necessarily stop when I want to. I can't control how much. I wind myself up in all kinds of weird, funky situations that I'm sure my wife will share about some of hers, which are very exciting. Basically a very broad stroke example of that was like when I was out there drinking and using, the universe was still loving me. This universe was still taking care of me and giving me opportunities and things that I wanted to show up for. But as soon as I put, you know, drugs and alcohol in my body, I was done because, you know, I'd hear about this opportunity. I'd call my friends about this opportunity. They'd be excited for me. I'd be excited for me. We'd go out, you know, to celebrate the opportunity. And that night out would turn into 4 months later, another jail sentence. Now, my intention, obviously, was not to end up in jail, but that's where drugs and alcohol always lead me. So that means that the drinking and using, the allergy aspect, really had nothing to do with good days or bad days or trauma or anything like that. It just had to do with how my body reacts to drugs and alcohol. And a couple other things about that allergy. I think that I didn't cross the line into alcoholism. I think I crossed the line into recognizing that I had this allergy where it was bad enough and consistent enough for me to actually see it. And also, there's no real way to heal the allergy. It's there for life, which means I can go see a psychiatrist and therapist and psychologist and understand the inner workings of my mind and heal my trauma and do all that stuff. But if I pick up a drink or a drug, I am fucked. It also means that I can go to different spiritual gurus at different ashrams all over the world and, you know, do year-long meditation fasts and, you know, basically be floating on water and really skinny. But if I put drugs and alcohol in my body, I'm still in the same position. But so that is really the piece that defines me as an alcoholic or an addict, right? Now, there's two other pieces that you know, talked about and probably mostly focused on in most meetings, which are the mental obsession and the spiritual malady. And the mental obsession a lot of times is described as like the incessant thinking about drinking and using all the time. But that was not really my experience. I was manufacturing methamphetamine. I didn't really have to think about it too much. I just had to reach over the table and pick up a shard and smoke it. But the mental obsession is really the ability to believe a lie. The lie as an alcoholic that I believe in the end is that I do not have the allergy, right? But the ability to believe a lie in and of itself is not necessarily alcoholism. I believe that every human being has the capacity to do so. And I think that if you don't believe that, you should probably just go on social media and check that out because people are lying to themselves all day. And, you know, when it really comes down to, you know, finding what the truth is, and I think more appropriate way to say this, finding when the truth is just now. And now I'm just sitting in a room with my beautiful wife and looking at a bunch of people sitting in squares on the computer. And there's nothing going on right now. There's no war right now. There's no politics in here right now. There's no bills to pay right now. There's nothing going on. Everything's chill. So when they talk about launching ourselves in the fourth dimension of existence in the Big Book, we're really talking about launching ourselves into the intersection of space and time, which is the absolute now. And that's where heaven can be found on earth, because like I said, I'm really happy right now. So that is the mental obsession. The spiritual malady is just all the emotional intangibility. It's the Depression, the anxieties, the fears, the worries, the jealousies, the anger, it's the feeling hopeless, feeling purposeless, feeling like every single person on this earth got some sort of manual how to function and exist successfully in this world, but God is like, fuck you, figure it out, right? Now, I don't believe that only alcoholics and addicts feel those feelings. I think every human being on this earth also has the capacity to experience all of that stuff. And I think that if you don't believe that, probably talk to some non-alcoholics because they are suffering too right now, you know? So I've just highlighted two pieces that are human condition, which is really what emotional sobriety is about. And one piece that defines me as an alcoholic and how they all kind of work together. Are you impressed with how quick that means?
Yeah, we talked about it too. I was like, can you do circle and triangle in 3 minutes?
2 minutes. Anyway. I know, we're doing right. So basically, how they all work together is that, you know, I believe a story in my head that's not necessarily rooted in reality. And then that triggers a negative emotional response. I get fearful, or I get jealous, or I get angry. And that feeling validates that thought. And now it's really real. And those things bounce off of each other and snowball. And I might have some more experiences that create more stories and more feelings till I get to this place where I'm living my life and I, you know, wake up in the morning and I open up my eyes and I'm in my bed. And the first thought is, you know, your wife is going to leave you. Your job's going to find out you're a fraud. You know, the world's going to fucking end because of World War III. There's all this stuff going on. Like, what's the point anyway? And the truth is that I just woke up. I open up my eyes. The truth is I'm just in my bed. Like literally nothing is going on. But when I'm in that much story and that much emotional manageability as a result of that story, I'm very susceptible to believing the end game line, which is a drink or a drug might fix this. Or, you know, maybe if I just manage it differently. I got sober when I was 22. Maybe it was just a phase. But either way, I pick up a drink or a drug, I trigger the allergy, and then I really enter into that phase of true powerlessness. And that's basically alcoholism, right? So it's two parts human condition that everybody experiences. And then one piece that defines me as an alcoholic, which means that if you think about it that way, there's no shame in fucking being alcoholic. There's no stigma when we have an allergy. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. We didn't choose to have that, and it's okay. So yeah, that's alcoholism. Mm-hmm. Now the solution for it, you want to talk about the solution?
Sure.
All right, good.
So since alcoholism is that three-part illness, the program is built to deal with all three parts, which gives it a three-part program. So the first part is the fellowship, which deals with the body. And as my husband said, the body part of this is very simple because the solution is abstinence. Right? If you don't ingest a drug or a drink, you won't trigger the allergy or abnormal reaction. Allergy is really just a metaphor for that, right? Because what we're looking at is that abnormal reaction triggers the phenomenon of craving. The pursuit of satisfying that craving then becomes my purpose. So that piece of it, again, very simple. The problem with that is that this mental obsession part, which is the difficulty that we face, because since we believe the lie and we have that built-in forgetter surrounding drugs and alcohol, we continue to pick back up, thus putting us right back in the cycle. So how the body's dealt with, again, is simple. It's just going into a meeting, for example, right? The fellowship piece of that treats that because I'm just putting my body in a safe place, right? For that hour, right? Even when we're looking at the screen for this hour, we are not at a bar. We are not at a dealer's house. We're not seeing our friend that we think we're trying to see, but really, you know, that friend always has drugs or alcohol in their house, right? We're just literally putting our body in a safe place. And what I tell people is that I imagine that most people in the world don't want to spend their entire lives in an Awana club or their entire every waking moment in a meeting, right? It's like that might be something that we do frequently, but in terms of constantly trying to avoid drugs or alcohol just by putting our body in a certain place isn't going to necessarily let us live the entirety of our lives, right? So, but in the beginning, that's why they tell you to go to so many meetings, 180 days or whatever it might be. That looks like my regimen for those first 18 months. But eventually I wanted to live life, right? So I have to treat the mind. Now, how the mind is treated is with the big book, Now, why the big book treats the mind is for two reasons. One of those is that it reminds us as we go through the diagnostic piece, because it contains that diagnosis of alcoholism and addiction, I'm constantly reminded that I have this thing, right? I'm relating to the literature. I'm talking to someone else about that. And we're bouncing these off of each other, remembering, oh yeah, that's what it looks like. Oh yeah, the times in which I told myself, oh, I'm only going to have a glass of wine with my grandmother on Christmas, wound me up, then having meth, then finding myself completely wasted in a motel room in East LA. That's where that one glass of wine gets me, even though my mind tells me that I'm only going to have a glass of wine, which sounds incredibly casual, but in practice, what the evidence is showing me is that every time I pick up a drink or a drug, I wind myself back up, right? So by revisiting that with people and remembering, especially with time sober and you get further from it, it's as if the mental obsession, you know, just continues to get stronger, right? Whereas these ideas, like Michaela said, oh, I was young, it was a phase, or, you know, oh, I never got to try that new drug that came out. Maybe if I did that, I'd be able to moderate, right? It's like all these things that we come up with in our mind that are just lies.
Or they sell it at a vape shop. It must be safe.
That's the other thing too. We were talking about that the other day, that it's important for people to talk about drugs, because I have little sponsees that'll tell me, oh, I went to buy an energy drink and it had this thing called Kratom in it. It's like, I don't know about that because I've been sober for 16 years and Michaela's been sober for 24 years. So for us hearing that, it's like, oh, this is very useful, right? Like, I need to know that if I'm just casually, you know, at a, I don't know, a tobacco store or at the gas station, that there might be something in there that's going to get us loaded that we've never even heard of. So it's helpful that other people, I guess, are doing the research. And sharing that information with us. So treating the mind, again, with the big book, does that one piece of it, which it, we revisit it, we go through the diagnosis again and again. And I will say this, I have heard other definitions of alcoholism, but the truth is they haven't landed on one, right? The best minds in neuroscience and psychiatry, geneticists, have been trying to figure out why our population reacts differently than other people to drugs and alcohol. And they have not landed on the theory yet. And also, what does that matter if what we are dealing with right here and right now is the abnormal reaction, right? We can let them debate all they want, but what we're still seeing, and like I said, the doctor calls it the allergy, which is just metaphorical, right? It's describing them. So us even going through that diagnosis and being able to find out, okay, I am an alcoholic, and revisiting that was important. That's one key part of our mental obsession. But mental obsession as a whole, right, which is that ability to believe a lie. And as Michaela said, we have a tendency to believe lies that have nothing to do with drugs and alcohol. But
sometimes they're benign too.
Totally. Like, seemingly benign.
Yeah. I mean, every time I go to sleep at night, I believe that I'm going to wake up the next morning. That's a story. That's not necessarily true. You know, we make plans with people. We have ambition. So the ability to believe a lie is not always a bad thing, but the thing is that if I'm just living in that space and I don't have anything to check that or any practice to get into the present moment, that stuff just runs everything. And it also runs into all these areas that could produce negative effects. So,
right. We're looking at the lies that produce the adverse emotional reactions, right? Those feelings that are manageable, which the big book describes as spiritual malady, right? If you were believing lies all day and they're making you happy, well, hey, who cares? Totally. It's working, right? But typically the lies that I believe are things that have to do with me being a piece of shit, or I'm, you know, unlovely in so many different ways, or I can't believe I said that thing. That person probably thinks I'm crazy. They probably think I'm so weird, right? It's like I judge myself on these things when in reality, I'm not actually here. I'm not actually here in this moment. And so there is something about the big book when you're reading it, and you're touching into the moment and you're working with someone, right? That you can be here. And suddenly you are in the truth, right? You are in the now. These are the things that, I mean, all of the greatest healers and teachers are trying to learn how to do, right? Trying to teach us how to communicate, how to be here now, right? And so we have this really simple way of doing that by just opening up the big book. And what I found was that getting into the truth that way, getting into the now that way, happened for me incredibly fast, right? I could do it right away because I didn't have to come up with some message. I couldn't keep anyone sober. I couldn't even keep myself sober. So it wasn't my message, right? Instead, I'm reading this book with someone and I'm able to touch in the moment versus like the alternative, which would have been, you know, I got suggestions like just sit through the feeling. I couldn't sit through a feeling. Couldn't sit through a feeling for years into my sobriety, right? Or when people would say, well, why don't you try and meditate on it? I couldn't meditate for a minute. And then even when I got some level of discipline to be able to sit for a period of time, which also took a long time, I used to call it marinating, because instead of meditating, I would just marinate in whatever the issue was. And I would just plot on how I was going to get my vengeance. And that's what I spent my time doing, which actually isn't what meditation is for, right? It wasn't uplifting. So that's why using a big book is going to treat the mind, right? It accesses truth. And then the third part of the program deals with the spirit, right? It's service. And
it's important to like understand what treating the spirit is, because I think that that's also misconceived. So the treatment of the spirit, it means to develop a relationship with and gain access to like the God of our choice, whatever we decided it was. And for me, it was really important to pick a concept of God that was rooted in logic. And rooted in logic for me means like, okay, cool. How do I want to feel as I exist in this earth, no matter what's going on in terms of life events? And really all I just wanted was to feel at peace and wanted to feel joy. And so I just had to ask myself, well, what kind of God do I need to believe in to feel at peace or feel joy? Because the 12-step program is really all about connecting to that power. And it was very simple. I just wanted to feel that I was taken care of no matter what, loved no matter what, and wanted the best for no matter what. And the reason why that allows me to live at peace and feel joy is because it means that I don't have to worry about my future, because that's always taken care of. It means that I don't have to have a bunch of shame and regret about my past, because obviously I was lucky that my life, I mean, I've been intervened on so many times, not just getting sober, but just, you know, with like lack of emotional sobriety in sobriety, where I've tried to kill myself multiple times in sobriety in my first 10 years, because I just was feeling like such shit inside, but something I'm still sitting here today and found a path of joy. But it also means that like, I don't have to just accept what's happening in front of me, but I can actually believe and choose to believe that every single situation that's presented to me in each moment is perfectly designed for me. So that is the concept of God I picked, because that's what would yield me the results that I want, right? And how I, basically what I'm describing as a God is like a universal servant to me, like a power that's just trying to serve me at all times. So the best way for me to develop a relationship or live in conscious contact with the servant is to practice service, right? To act God-like, to be the servant to the moment in front of me. Now, it's important to understand that like service needs to be a selfish practice. So there can't be any expectation of reciprocation, just like the God that I chose doesn't expect anything from me, right? It's been loving me whether I wanted God or believed in God or not. You know, these were definitely experiences in my life where the universe was conspiring in my favor, times where I did not believe in God or was cursing the idea of God. So the practice of, you know, unconditional service to the moment in front of me always winds up putting me in the most powerful position, because when I am just trying to be the blessing to you without any expectation of reciprocation, I don't want anything back from you, whether it's tangible or validation or anything, then you can't fuck with me. You can't affect my emotional stability, you know? And that's like a diligent practice of getting outside of self that has like brought me to the position that I'm in today, where I actually get to live like that, you know what I mean? So I think that it's important to understand that piece, because you know, in AA meetings, people talk about service and they tell you all these different ways to be of service. They tell you to get a service commitment at a meeting, or they tell you to drive newcomers from treatment center to sober livings to meetings, or they tell you to, you know, just be kind to, you know, your mom who you've had like a horrible relationship with for years or whatever, you know, and all that's fine and dandy. And there's definitely ways and times where those things do work, but I can't guarantee that I can be out of self at all times in those situations. For example, I can get a commitment at one of the Alano clubs here in California, and I can get the mopping commitment, right? And I can be mopping the floor at that Alano club after a meeting and be thinking to myself, that speaker sucked, or why is nobody talking to me? Or, you know, I really am so annoyed with that one person who shares, he's always preaching, and that person's always whining. Or is anyone noticing what a great job I'm doing mopping this floor? Like, why is no one coming up and telling me how shiny it is, you know? So like self is just like infesting that moment. So it's not really service. Or driving newcomers from treatment centers to meetings, like everything is fine and dandy until a newcomer spills a milkshake in my back seat. And I'm like, what the fuck, bro? You know what I mean? Like, now I got to get a car wash, you know, how am I going to get this shit out, right? So self like gets involved there. Or opening up doors for people at, you know, grocery stores and stuff. You know what I mean? Everything's fine and dandy until someone doesn't say thank you, or someone gets offended that I opened up a door thinking that I'm like a misogynist or something, like whatever it is, right? So like self gets involved there. So I need like a truly selfless practice, something where I have no expectation of reciprocation and no skin in the game and no way that my pride can get attached to it because I'm not taking credit for it. And the best and most efficient way that I know to get into a selfless practice and also work the program is taking people through the big book. Why is the big book a selfless practice, babe?
Because it's not our message.
It's not our message.
Yeah. And also too, to your point where it's like, ultimately that does extend out. Ultimately it, through the practice of getting out of self, helps us be aware of when we are out of self. That opening up the door, and if someone says thank you or not, doesn't matter, right? It's like that does happen, but I think aiming for it in that way of like, okay, I'm gonna do this commitment and it's going to make me get out of self, but what it actually does is potentially just places further into self because of the selfishness, right? And the self-centeredness and the fact that I'm not treating my mind at the same time with the big book, and then feeling very defeated by that. And that's really what we're talking to, is that if commitments do work for people, that's amazing. It just hasn't consistently always worked for me when I really needed to get out of self. And so having the way, because even with what you're saying, it's like when I heard the God stuff when I came in, I mean, I couldn't access that. And I didn't believe in God. I had a willingness to believe, which was all that I ultimately needed. And the truth is that everyone that's in this room today is the result of grace, whether we know it or not, right? Because being locked in that impossible situation of what alcoholism is, which is that I have a body that can't stop drinking and I have a mind that compels me to do it, right? Is an impossible situation. So us even answering the call and being intervened on is universe working on our behalf. But when I came in, I would not have been able to tell you that. What I thought was that the police had screwed me over, that my parents had screwed me over, that rehab was a joke, and that they're making me do these silly things. I didn't think anyone in this
2 minutes, please, guys,
was actually sober, right? So that was the perception that I had. But really what I could hang my hat on was getting out of self, specifically with the big book, right? Like the group I was involved with pushed me to work with others right away. I mean, they told me this was an altruistic movement and that that was what this whole thing was about. So in doing so, what I found was I would get relief from the book sessions. Now, The longer term relief, again, took time. But suddenly, meditation did become accessible, right? doing commitments did become accessible. But still to this day, I choose the book sessions because I know that no matter what, they will work. That when all else fails, working with another alcoholic will save the day, which has been my truth since the moment I came in here. So even with the other stuff, there are still loud days mentally, right? Not as many, and they're pretty infrequent, but, you know, I can't always stare at the orange tree and be completely at peace and out of self. But I know that if I sit down with another alcoholic, no matter what is going on, and read the big book with them, I can. Like, you literally have a way out of self into spirit, whether we call it that or not. There's so many other ways to describe it, but that's exactly what it does, which is the fortune, in a sense, of, I mean, really so many reasons for Alcoholics Anonymous, but the rehabilitative part of this not only keeps us physically sober, but we can be in a recovered state of mind and body. It's just that we only have a daily reprieve when it comes to the mind, which means we have to do it every day.
So emotional sobriety is really just about treating the human condition. And we're actually really blessed as alcoholics to have a very simple path to that. You treat the mind through being the book, and you treat the spirit through being of service. So when you're of service by teaching the book to another human being who's sober, you wind up treating all three sides of the triangle because you're in the unity, you're in the recovery, and you're in the service. So that's really what the program is and how it works, you know? And I really want to say this for the newcomer, because there's this ideology that's passed around that you have to work all 12 steps before you can pass it on, right? Because you can't transmit what you have in God and blah, blah, blah. And I just want to tell you that that is bullshit. And I just want to empower you to understand that you are useful today, that you have purpose today. And if this whole idea of working all 12 steps before you can help people was how this program is designed, none of us would be sitting here, right? Like, when Ebby came to Bill, he only had 60 days of sobriety, and there was no book. There was no meetings. There was like a loose six-step program. And the sixth step, which is a reflection of the 12-step that we have today, didn't say start working with alcoholics. It says continue to work with alcoholics, which means that you've been doing it the whole time, right? And, you know,
Bill and Bob only had one day.
Totally. He started working with people in his first 6 months, like immediately. Like, he was the dude going to the other guy in the detox bed next to him and carrying a message that Eddie passed on to him. Like, that's how this thing worked, you know? And, you know, 6 months down the line in Bill's sobriety, when he worked with a shit ton of people and no one was staying sober, he goes to Akron on a business venture, you know, that he's betting his entire life on because he hadn't been working for like 5.5 years. And that business venture falls through. And he was like put into an amazing amount of fear, resentment, like just all kinds of self-pity, like all this stuff, right? Which is really what...
That's time, guys. Thank you.
Say what?
We've run out of time.
Oh, okay, cool. Can I finish the story quickly? Or no?
Really quickly, I'll
be quick. Anyway, the bottom line is that he's in all this emotional manageability, which is the opposite of emotional sobriety. And it doesn't say that in order to save himself, he had to call a sponsor. In order to save himself, he had to go to a meeting. In order to save himself, he needed to hit his knees and pray. It said in order to save himself, he must carry the message from an alcoholic. So if you get a message, which is in the book, you don't have to come up with it yourself, and you're new, pass that on. You know, so I just hope that you find somebody who knows how to teach you the big book, and then just pass it on and do it as a daily practice and do it as you learn it. And that will absolutely change your life and put you on the path to emotional sobriety from day one. Thanks.